Healthy Alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. I'm Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you're listening to WebTalkRadio.net. What Healthy Alternatives is about, most of us really want to reach optimal levels of health and wellness. We want to feel better, live longer, and enjoy life even more. And that's what I attempt to bring you on each of the Healthy Alternative shows. My guest I'm going to be interviewing a little later today is Julie Hill. She's the executive director of a humanitarian organization in Norfolk, Virginia, called Outreach Africa Lost Boys Foundation. This is a all-volunteer, nonprofit organization that serves Sudanese refugees known as the Lost Boys and Girls. And their story is quite amazing of the level of what they had to go through to get to this country, and also how important they view education, not only for themselves here, but for their relatives back in the area of Sudan and surrounding countries. Julie has been the recipient of 2 humanitarian awards. We'll talk more about that, and we're going to be talking to her in just a few minutes. Every week, I like to begin the show by talking about an issue or concern you should know about because it can have a real impact on you. What I want to talk about today is that in the government, the Department of Energy has just released a proposal that would allow, get this, 14,000 tons of radioactive metal to be recycled for use in any consumer goods. That means your sunglasses, your steel water bottle, your braces, your hip replacement can all have radiation in it. See, there's currently suspension in place that restricts the release of the scrap metal, that they can't release it for the purpose of recycling. So the suspension has been in place since 2000, and it was imposed because of public concerns about the potential health and environmental effects of radioactive metal coming from these locations. So the Department of Energy has now proposed to modify the suspension and allow this metal to be released into recycling to be used in any industry. What DOE is saying is that the benefits are a decrease in the need for mining and refining metals due to recycling of these materials, that it would reduce land use, reduce disturbances to geology and soils, reduce greenhouse gases. Well, it's only really a negligible amount of reduction you're talking about, because you're only talking about 14,000 tons of material. However, what happens to radioactive material, it actually builds up in our body, it bioaccumulates, and its persistence in the body can last for years and years and years. See, Department of Energy actually attempted this before in the 1990s, and in 2000 they allowed government recycling of metal from nuclear sites. And what they found is inadequate testing of materials was discovered. One test even showed that metals with radioactive levels that were several times higher than they were supposed to be. So you think you can trust your government to really make sure there are no problems with radioactivity when they can't even stop Salmonella infecting the food supply? Good luck on that thought. If you'd like to learn more about me, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, you can go to my website at teplitz.com, and you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I do a free monthly e-newsletter called the Teplitz Report. It's different information from healthy alternatives. You can learn about that at teplitz.com. You can click on the About Home button. You can sign up there. Every week I like to talk to you about a healthy breakthrough, the newest discoveries, latest information about healthy alternatives you can use for your family, yourself, and loved ones. What I want to talk about, and this is aimed at women who are pregnant, both before they get pregnant and during the pregnancy, the importance of taking folic acid supplements. Now, folic acid has been recommended because it prevents deformities in the spinal column. We can now go further because autism is a illness disease that is epidemic in this country. It now affects 1 out of 88 kids in this country. And what the researchers in this study found, that they had 85,000 Norwegian children, and they had the doctors have them fill out forms and questionnaires about supplement use before and during pregnancies, and they followed the children for an average of 6 years. What they found is the women who took folic acid supplements both before and during pregnancy were about 40% less likely to have a baby later diagnosed with autism. And this also includes the severe kind of autism as well as Asperger's syndrome. They needed, though, to be taking it before they get pregnant and through at least the first 8 weeks of pregnancy, because they found if they took it at, say, week 22 mid-pregnancy, it did not decrease the risk. What folic acid does, it's a B vitamin, and it's essential for synthesizing and repairing DNA. So it seems to play a key role in the first days and weeks of the embryo's life before women even know that they're pregnant. So the recommendation that would apply to taking folic acid to prevent spinal column problems also holds for preventing autism. So they're talking about 400 micrograms of folic acid per day. Before I bring on my guest, Julie Hill, I want to talk about a book that I've done called Switched On Networking. My co-author is Donna Fisher. She is an authority on networking. She's written a number of books on networking, and this latest with me, she does in each section the chapters about networking face-to-face, social media networking, and then I do this concept of brain rewiring at the end of each chapter to switch you on for the information that Donna presents. To learn more about this, you can go to my website at www.switchedonnetworking.com. You can also go to Amazon and purchase it there. My guest today is Julie Hill. She's the executive director in Virginia Beach, Norfolk area of a local humanitarian organization called Outreach Africa Lost Boys Foundation. This is an all-volunteer nonprofit that serves the Sudanese refugees that are known as the Lost Boys and Girls who settled in this area of Hampton Roads. They provide advocacy, financial assistance, focusing on a medical and educational assistance both for the South Sudanese living here and also their relatives who are still refugees in Africa. Julie, in 2012, was the recipient of two humanitarian awards. One was the prestigious Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Leaders Award from the Urban League of Hampton Roads, and the other was the Community Service Award from Old Dominion University and Town and Gown. She's been serving with
and working for these Sudanese refugees for over 12 years. And for transparency, I am on the board of the organization as well. So, Julie, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Hi, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
So for people who don't know, can you give kind of a synopsis of what are the Lost Boys and Girls?
The Lost Boys and Girls are a group of refugees that came to the U.S. approximately 12 years ago. They initially were a group of 30,000 young people who fled their villages in Sudan, in the southern part of the country of Sudan, when they were bombed by the government in the north. And they fled first to Ethiopia, lived there 3 years in refugee camps, and then to Kenya and lived there for approximately 9 years in a refugee camp there. They have a very specific history, and it's this criteria that they had to meet to come to the U.S., and they were called the Lost Boys and Girls after the kids in Peter Pan. They were named that after a journalist met them.
What people may not also realize in their having to flee South Sudan, that most of their parents were killed in the villages, and they had to actually walk 1,200 miles without just food, without other than what they had on their back, water, and half of them died. Then a bunch of years later, they were kicked out of the country they were in because the government had changed, and same kind of thing had to happen. So these are people who went through, as children, horrendous experiences, correct?
Absolutely. They faced starvation on a daily basis. They went without food and water. They tried to travel at night to avoid the helicopter gunships that were looking for them. The northern government was determined to kill them because they saw them as future soldiers for the South, the Southern Freedom Fighters. And they did spend months in the desert traveling from one country to another. And even when they were in refugee camps, they had very small rations of food. They were given a large cup of cornmeal about the size of a drinking glass that had to last them 15 days, and they would go days every month with no food.
By the way, one of the reasons in terms of this being the Healthy Alternative show is that when we get to the end of this, we're going to be really talking about how Julie has been really able to create happiness, meaning not only for herself, but lots of folks out of real chaos and confusion. So, Julie, how did you wind up getting together with the South Sudanese when because they had come to Hampton Roads, and how did you run across them?
Well, first of all, this was the biggest blessing in my entire life to come across these people. I had already had some African anthropology classes in college. I had bought books on African tribal art and cultures, and I ended up finding a book that focused a lot on the Dinka tribe, and I just thought they were the most amazing people I had ever seen photographed. They had a wisdom in their eyes that transcended the photographs, and so I was very focused on them, and then I started hearing about the genocide in Sudan and that the Dinka were targets. And the other southern Sudanese tribes were also targets of the northern government. And so about 4 or 5 years after I heard about them, and a couple of years after I had an injury when I was sidelined in life, I happened to go to my local grocery store, and there were two young Dinka men. They looked like they were about 20 years old, and they were bagging groceries and pushing the carts. And I was just absolutely astounded that the people that I cared about so much but couldn't help because I couldn't travel, they were right there in front of me. And it was an amazing, amazing moment in my life. And I ended up stalking them for 3 days. I'd go to the store, put groceries in my cart.
You're a stalker, huh?
I'm a stalker. But I was so fascinated by them, and I didn't want to embarrass them by making them feel like they looked different than anyone, that I could, single them out. So after 3 days on my third trip there, I actually went up through the checkout line where one of them was bagging groceries and asked him if he was from Sudan. And he looked at me and he said yes. And then I asked if he was Dinka, and he about fell out. He couldn't believe anyone knew the tribe he was from. And then I asked how he came to be here, because I had never heard of the Lost Boys. I didn't know their story. And he just said that was a story that was too long to tell. But I told him that somehow I was going to help them. I could tell that they were sort of here on their own, and certainly this was a totally alien place to them. So suddenly my life that seemed to be without any purpose because I was disabled suddenly had...
You're actually at a very low place in your life at the point that you met.
I was. I was suicidal at the time, and I had actually planned on killing myself. I hadn't chosen the moment, didn't know the exact method, but I'd even gone so far as to order the books on how to do it and books for my friends on how to deal with it. And I was in so much pain and felt so worthless and alone that I just didn't want to be here anymore. But that moment saved me. It really did.
And so how did that then grow in the relationship? So you started meeting the two, and then what began to happen?
I tried contacting the church that first brought them over here, and I found out these were two of 3,800 young men, mostly called Lost Boys. There were a few girls, but mostly boys. And the church gave me their address and told me where I could go see a group of them in their apartment. So I just decided I was going to screw up my courage and go over there. And I was feeling pretty low at the time and very shy and still doubting myself a bit. And I wasn't afraid of them at all. I was actually concerned that I would scare them or... you know, that they would just wonder who this stranger was and wonder what my motives were. But I went ahead and just decided I was going to go over to their apartment, and I knocked on the door, and a young man answered, and I asked him if he wanted to learn how to cook a chicken and vegetables, and he just said yes, and I asked him to get in my car, and we went to the store and bought the food and came home and prepared it. And I was just amazed that this young man would get in my car and go with me like that in a gesture of blind faith. And the irony is I found out later that he's was literally legally blind. He had a vitamin deficiency blindness. So he could see to get around, but he couldn't see any details about me.
One of the interesting things is that, for listeners to know, that I saw a film about the Lost Boys, and when they came to this country, because they came from a totally agrarian society that basically didn't have any what we call modern conveniences, so these kids wind up getting dumped literally into a U.S. apartment, and they don't know what a toilet is, what a refrigerator is, what a stove is, and it was actually pretty funny watching how they've recreated how we think things get used in the bathroom and everything.
It is amazing. I found out when they first came, and I met them just like 3 months after they first came, that they would sleep with the lights on, not knowing they could turn them off, or they would sit in the dark at night, not knowing they could turn lights on. Plus, they had been taught never to touch other people's belongings, so they were afraid to use any of these things. And they thought that the toilet was one of the most amazing things they'd ever seen. They'd never had a toilet, so they thought it was too amazing to soil. They weren't sure they should be using it. And they would repurpose things like a coffee pot and a hammer handle. They would repurpose as a mortar and pestle to grind up their cereal like it was flour. It was quite a learning curve when they came here. There was a guy that came a couple of years after the first fellas, and he was in my car. I was taking him to the store, and I pressed the button to lower his window, and when it started to go down, he absolutely freaked out. Almost jumped in my lap. It scared him badly.
There's a ghost in the car.
Yeah. So little things that you don't think of were just all new to them. Everything was new. It was like they had come from another planet because they didn't have any, you know, even the lowest technology in these refugee camps that they lived in. And the main camp had 85,000 other refugees, and they were going to the most modest of schools under a tree and sitting on lumps of soil and doing their lessons in the dirt with their fingers. They've just told me the most amazing stories about, you know, how they coped and how they learned their lessons for school.
Let me interrupt for a second, Julie, because before we continue, I'd like to remind you, you're listening to Healthy Alternatives with Dr. Jerry Teplitz on webtalkradio.net. We'll be back with my guest, Julie Hill, in just a moment.
It's starting to warm up. For those of you who are golfers, I want to point you in the direction of a DVD that I've done that can also be downloaded called Par and Beyond Secrets to Better Golf. It's looking at the energetics under the golf game and what can you do to really make a difference in how you perform and function. I've had golfers just watch the DVD, apply what was in it, go out next time they golfed, and shoot their personal best ever. To learn more about Par and Beyond Secrets to Better Golf, you can go to teplitz.com. You'll see the products button. You'll get a drop down and click on DVDs, and you can learn about Par and Beyond Secrets to Better Golf.
So my guest today is Julie Hill. She's the executive director of Outreach Africa Lost Boys Foundation. It's an all-volunteer nonprofit that serves Sudanese refugees known as Lost Boys and Girls that have settled in this part of Virginia called Hampton Roads. And it provides advocacy, financial assistance, focus on medical and educational assistance, not only for the boys and girls living here, but also for their relatives who live in Africa still. She's received two humanitarian community service awards. One is the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Leaders Award, and the other is the Community Service Award from Old Dominion University and Town and Gown. So, Julie, let's talk about how they viewed education and how the Lost Boys and Girls here viewed their obligation to help their relatives back in Africa.
Well, about education, they think that is the most valuable asset anybody can have. Since these young people were living as orphans, and they either were absolutely orphaned or they didn't know if their parents were dead or alive because they had been separated from them for years and had no way of receiving news of if they were alive or dead, they valued education above all else, and they had the motto that education is our mother and our father. So they focused every bit of their energy on education, even though it was very rudimentary in the refugee camp. They, at first, as I said, were going to school under the trees. Eventually, they did receive books, but they would have to take one book and divide it into 10 pieces. They would take a pencil and break it into four pieces. They had very little in the way of paper or reading materials. And they even told me they would practice writing in the air. I mean, the things they say are the most amazing. And because of their experience and how much they value education, they make very good speakers for students and children in our schools here, to help them appreciate the education they're receiving and the resources that we have here.
And then how did it come about where they started to educate, paying for educating their relatives back in Africa?
Well, they have a huge obligation since coming to the U.S. to support their families. When the families are living as refugees and they're in Kenya and Uganda, they cannot work in their host countries. They can't earn any money at all and compete with the local people. So all the relatives there are totally dependent on the people that are outside and have come to the United States or Australia or Canada. And so these lost boys and girls here who are now in their early 30s, at the time they were around 20 years old, they were obligated emotionally and ethically, morally, to take care of their extended families. And they have many brothers and sisters and cousins. And so since they value education above everything, what they wanted to do was to put these relatives through school, get them an education any way they could. So most of them were sacrificing their own educations here and their own opportunities here by working two jobs and then supporting their relatives in school. And two of them had asked me to help educate their relatives, so I ended up sponsoring four children, and I realized how appealing that was to me to be able to help them in this way. So when we would go on speaking engagements, I took pictures of other children that wanted to go to school and who needed sponsorship, and amazingly, the people that we spoke to responded to this, and it turned into our boarding school program.
And how many children have, and it's people who are individuals in this country who are sponsoring these kids, how many kids have people sponsoring them?
Well, we have over 140 students right now in our program. We have about 12 who are seeking sponsors at the moment. They're all relatives of the local Sudanese lost boys and girls here in our community, but these children are in Kenya and Uganda. And we have a few in South Sudan, and they do totally depend on their sponsors here for tuition, but these payments will also pay for their room and board as well. And it takes a tremendous strain off of the Sudanese living here to have people here who care enough to help their relatives.
And my fiance and I learned about this and decided to sponsor one of the students, and Julie came to us and said, we got a kid who's 19 years old and wants to go to school. And so as opposed to sponsoring a little kid, we sponsored this this 19-year-old, 6'5" plus, who's in first grade. And in about 6 or 7 years, he's completed 13 years of schooling. They just keep promoting him. He just graduated, and now he wants to go to law school, and we're looking to help support him in that. And this is all happening in Africa for him.
His is an amazing, amazing story. He's quite a focused and determined young man, a high achiever. And that reminds me that I did ask one of the local lost boys how it happened that they were all such high achievers, and they said it was because they had no plan B. And the same for this young man. He was so determined to go to first grade that he walked across South Sudan to Uganda so he could contact a relative here and let it be known that he was there waiting and hoping and praying that somebody would care enough about him to enable him to go to school. So, Jerry, and thank you to you and Elizabeth for answering that call.
Now, you're welcome. And what have you learned from the Sudanese as to how they have dealt with this literally lifelong struggle for themselves?
It's been amazing to learn how they do deal with the challenges and the strife and all the horrible things that have happened to them in their lives. In our culture, it seems like we dwell on every bad thing that happens to us, and we carry it with us like it's baggage and a tremendous weight that kind of bogs us down in our lives. But the Sudanese will just look ahead. They focus on the future. If they focused on the things that happened to them daily in their past, where they were attacked by helicopter gunships, their friends were eaten by lions, they were bitten by snakes, they died of starvation and and thirst. You know, they saw their friends passing away every day. And if they focused on that, I don't think they would be alive today. So through a very strong spirituality and faith and focusing on the future, they just keep moving ahead. And they are extremely high achievers. Many in our area here who were fortunate enough to settle in Norfolk have been able to graduate from Old Dominion University, and some are now in graduate school. It's just an amazing story of overcoming.
What other lessons do you say we can learn besides this notion of looking ahead, which is extremely important, would you say is that their culture would teach us?
One thing is there's sort of living in an era or like our past with our grandparents where they never say anything bad about anyone. They don't speak ill of each other or other people. They never lie. They're such easy people to deal with because I know they're always telling me the truth. And if because they don't talk about other people, if I want to know something about one of them, and I'll say, how's Abraham doing on his new job? They'll say, well, you need to ask Abraham that. So it's very refreshing to deal with people who I can trust, who are honest. And the other thing that I have found is that they have a great respect of their elders, and they really take care of their elders, and they're seen as the wise people in their society. So whenever one of them pauses to express their gratitude to me, I only half jokingly say, you know, don't thank me now. You may be taking care of me later on in life. At least I'd like to think that maybe.
In terms of for the listeners, is there a way if they would like to help support what the foundation does, they can do that and also be aware every single dollar that comes in, since I'm on the board, I know this, goes to support the lost boys and girls here with the needs that they have that are extraordinary, as well as sponsoring these children back in Africa in the boarding school program. So how can people get involved, Julie?
Oh, great. As you stated, we are all volunteers, so all the money that's donated goes to help the Sudanese. We take no compensation at all, and we're not reimbursed for things like gas or time or anything like that. But if anybody wants to become a sponsor, they can contact me through the website or directly with my email. Website is www.lostboysus.org, LOSTBOYSUS.org. And then my email is julhill@cox.net. They can choose a child they would like to sponsor. We have photographs, we have report cards, or they can allow us to choose one. They can say if they prefer a boy or a girl. And it's really easy to match them up. If I have a student whose relatives live here on the south side, I try to match him up with somebody who also lives on the south side so they can meet the lost boy or girl and form a relationship with them as well if they would like to. And so they'll get direct updates from the relative here on the child that they're sponsoring. And if the sponsor lives in Newport News, I try to match him up with somebody living over there whose relative is in our program. And we do have people from around the country who sponsor children. And we also have classes and schools and churches and temples who also sponsor children. It's a real community-based effort, and I get to meet the most wonderful people in the world who do this.
So for listeners who'd like to pursue this further, you can go to the website at lostboysus.org. Julie, thanks for being a guest today on Healthy Alternatives.
Thank you, Jerry. I enjoyed it.
My guest next week is Christy Kolinsky. She's a senior program manager with the Center for Healthy Aging. That is within the National Council of Aging. It's a nonprofit service and advocacy group, and their mission is to improve the lives of millions of older adults, especially those who are vulnerable and disadvantaged. So what Christy does is provides technical assistance, guidance, program management to state government agencies, community-based organizations that are implementing evidence-based healthy aging programs. We're going to be talking to her about these programs and the kind of impact they're having on the lives of older Americans. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz. You can find out more about me at teplitz.com, or you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you, or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.